Hello, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. I know we're short a few members, but they'll be trickling in. So this is the House Interim Task Force on Small Businesses. And today is Thursday, November 21st. And we're going to change up the order just a little bit because I understand there's some conflict in scheduling. Co-chair Barton will be running the meeting when he gets here. He's up doing a bill signing and getting his picture taken with the governor. So as soon as they're done with that, he'll be down here. But until then, I'll go ahead and get started. So we are going to take up the second agenda item first, and that's an update on regulatory streamlining and simplification project. And much like all government, we can't just make that short. We've got to make it a long title as we're talking about streamlining. So with that, I'll have Michael Jordan, the Chief Operating Officer and Director of the Department of Administrative Services, come up. Looks like you got some entourage.
Yes, and friends.
Welcome to the task force. We're pretty informal in task force. As you can see, I don't even wear a tie for task force. So, welcome.
Appreciate that.
Great.
Co-chair, I'm going to let Scott start. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Scott Nelson, and I'm a policy advisor to the governor. And I was the person in the governor's office who was first involved in this project. In December of 2010, the Oregon Business Council had in its policy playbook a recommendation that such an effort be undertaken. And the direction there was very simple: simplify and streamline. And later in that legislative session, Senator Telfer and others sponsored a bill to set up a task force to take on a very similar effort. And so at some point near the end of that session, in the midst of end of session pig pen like things flying around, we decided to just join the efforts together. And the Attorney General, John Kroger, at the time, took up the effort with us, and his staff, Fred Granham, who was special counsel to the Attorney General at the time, organized this effort, engaging several dozen stakeholders from both within government and without. That was in August, probably about August of 2011. And for the next year, that group worked together and ultimately produced the report in fall of 2012. I am not the expert on all the items in the report. If you've had a chance to take a look at it, it is a wide-ranging report. And the group that put it together really was focused. There's a couple common themes throughout, but one of them is really on enterprise-level work at the state level, and I think Michael will have some comments on that. It's continuous improvement in agencies. It's IT systems. It's things that ultimately, I think, trickle down to make the small business experience, the user experience, much friendlier. And then on the flip side, there were a few pilot projects mentioned and also very concrete, hands-on elements recommending business ombudsmen. Folks who could essentially be a Sherpa, for the lack of a better word, through the regulatory process. And my colleague Greg Wolf, who runs our regional solutions program, will be able to speak to some of those successes and how that's worked out. In fact, as a concrete matter, one of the very first victories for this report was that we were actually able to get money in the last budget to staff some ombudsman positions. I will hand this over to Michael. He is much more important than I and much smarter than I. A couple of things that may not get covered by these two. If you haven't before, you should take a look at the Secretary of State's Business Express website, which over the past 3 or 4 years has been developed as a single portal for business licensing and other regulatory issues. And a second piece along those lines is DCBS has an e-permitting site. And what they have done, and I think this is really interesting, Wolf might have some things to say about this, what they have done is actually, and one of the things we identified about the regulatory system generally is that it's often very hard to get at the root of the issue because it's multi-jurisdictional, right? You're dealing with federal, state, local regs. It's hard to tell what's what, and sometimes they overlap, right? And what they've done at DCBS is actually integrated, again, a single portal through which you can deal with both at the state level, and I think they have something like nearly 40 local jurisdictions that are working through that site now for building permit related issues. So just those are two highlights of things that were in the report that I think this task force, it would be well worth the task force looking at and thinking about and asking the question of the Secretary of State, of Pat Allen at DCBS, what is it that you need that could help accelerate these efforts? Because I think that they've been successful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state and the Director of the Department of Administrative Services. Thank you for having us today. I'm going to fly at a pretty high level and pretty quickly. There were five major strategic initiatives that came out of the report. I'm going to speak, again, at a fairly general level about them, provide a couple of examples of how we've done. The report was issued in August of 2012, so we're just, a little more than a year out from the initial report coming out, and I think I can say we've made some fairly significant progress on a number of the initiatives. So the first one, which is very broad, as Scott mentioned, but at an enterprise level, really fundamental to how we do business, and really no organization can really prosper unless they have kind of a coherent way of thinking about what management means. And the first strategic initiative in the report was to build a consistent, coherent management system for state government. As you well know, we're a bit fragmented. We have 92 agencies. We're north of 300 boards and commissions. To date, we have not really managed that effort as an enterprise. I'm here to tell you that we're right on the verge of moving to a common management framework and system by which we identify processes and goals and metrics for success and accountabilities and ways to improve those processes in a common way across that very fragmented structure that we have right now. Currently, over the last 5 to 7 years, so this work did precede the report, but we now are up to, as a metric, 23,796 of our 38,279 employees in the executive branch of state government, or 62% of them, now work under some level of maturity, and I say that because every agency is at a different level of maturity in implementing this common management system. So about 62% of our employees are working now under that management system, so they're at least to some degree familiar, some of them very familiar. The Oregon Youth Authority and the Department of Environmental Quality are probably the furthest down the road in implementing that system. What that will allow us to do over time is really be able to speak about how we manage our programs in a common language, in a common framework. You well know that many of our employees, and particularly management employees, as they move through their career, often move from agency to agency. And to move in a common way of talking about how we manage and how we measure success is a huge advantage for us. And so that is, as I said, 62% of our employees, I would caution to say that of the about a dozen agencies that are now currently working the framework, they're at different levels of maturity. So, for instance, Colette Peters, who was at OIA, started this structure there, and they are quite mature in it and doing a really good job. She now has carried that ball to the Department of Corrections. They are just beginning that process. So different levels of maturity, but we're working our way towards that common framework. The other thing I would say under this is it's difficult to do almost anything in a common way without the leadership of state government working together on it. And so when I came 2.5 years ago, formulated what we call the Enterprise Leadership Team, it's the agency directors of 20 state agencies and the deputies of the 4 statewide elected offices who come together on a regular basis to go through just these kinds of discussions. What is going to be our common way of managing? How are we going to deal with IT, which I'll get to in just a second? Those kinds of things. The second initiative in the report was to talk about how to develop a 21st century information technology system. For the first time in the state's history, a year ago, we got a report. We asked some consulting help to come in and assess our internal services, the biggest of which, of course, is information technology. And we gathered quite a bit of data around the way we do technology in state government. Just a couple of tidbits of data. We currently have as of about a year ago when the report came out, we had 2,814 different applications that we used in state government. By comparison, that's about 1,000 applications more than our peer states. And in our study, we had 14 peer states that we compared ourselves against. And about 1,500 more, about double what a world-class organization, public or private, of our size and scope would have. So we've got a whole bunch of folks who are chasing a whole bunch of applications, which probably some level of consolidation should be done. We, up until very recently, have had a very difficult time governing our technology at all. Again, back to that fragmented management structure that we have in this organization. A lot of that was to have fallen, at least in theory, to the Department of Administrative Services. I will tell you, historically, we have not exercised a lot of authority over agencies regarding technology. And the reason for that, at least in my view, is we didn't have any way to govern in a very structured way decisions about technology. I'm fond of telling people in the organization we can't even make a bad decision because we don't have any way to govern this IT effort that we have. So we have spent, you may recall that House Bill 3258 passed in the last session. Representative Harker was the chief sponsor of that bill. It made the chief information officer for the state a governor's appointment, reporting to me on a day-to-day basis, but also laid out a number of duties for the chief information officer, one of which was to develop an IT governance structure. We will bring something to the 14th session of a new structure for governing IT in this organization. The fundamental challenge is the flexibility to be responsive and nimble to an individual program buried in some agency, and the ability to gather economies of scale and control a proliferation of applications. So there's a tension there that has to be monitored, if you will, and we will bring a new approach to doing that. We also will be responsive to a bill that did not pass but was proposed by Representative Vega Peterson in the last session about how do we deal with, remember, the north of 300 boards and commissions, and probably two-thirds of our agencies are relatively small and really don't have a lot of capacity to deal with difficult or complex IT questions. And so how do we put a service orientation that really makes sure that we're doing a good job with that? So that's initiative number two. Initiative number three was align state initiatives. As you know, we're doing a lot of things in a lot of places right now. We are doing significant change that the legislature has approved policy for in education and in healthcare. We are also, through a governor's executive order, looking at reworking and aligning the workforce development system, which now lies in at least 4 agencies in state government. You will hear a proposal in the 14th session for a realigning and structuring of the Housing and Community Services Agency and the State Library that we have proposed and you adopted in the budget. We're coming back in 14 with realignments there. The one that is kind of the hottest right now, if you will, is our response to House Bill 2620, which was to take all of the programs within the economic and community development policy area of state government and try to align them better to servicing the priorities that have been articulated in the 11 regional solutions areas across the state. So, in other words, in my shorthand, take what we do in state government, providing services to communities, and align it in a much more coherent way and responsive way to the priorities of those communities. So we are going through a process right now, engaging with a broad group of stakeholders and gathering data from those regions and from those communities. My words again, how they receive state service. We got a lot of people inside state government that can tell you how we deliver state service. Coupling that expertise in program delivery to the experience of communities and practitioners in the field about how they experience those programs when they land in a community is a very different kind of dialogue. And we're going through that right now, and we hope to bring you a number of proposals in the 14th session about how we can change the way we do business that makes us more responsive to those issues in the field. I want to parenthetically say something here because it's pretty important, and it is an emerging challenge that I think we have to get our heads around. As I said, we've got a major effort going to move resource and accountability and responsibility for delivery in education to the local regions, school districts, community colleges, and universities. We have an early learning effort that involves a number of service providers to children from 0 to 5 to make them ready to learn. We have a healthcare initiative that you know a lot about that is attempting to move flexibility and delivery of healthcare services through CCOs to local areas. We weren't as successful, but we made some progress in moving resources from our most expensive remediation tool, prison beds, to one that is more responsive in local governments to supervision in the field. Not a huge change there, but a beginning of a shift. And this 2620 effort in community and economic development is really talking about how do we move resource, accountability, and flexibility and responsiveness to communities on the ground. What we're experiencing now is that in multiple realms, out in communities, folks on the ground are going, now, wait a minute, I'm on a CCO, I'm on an early learning council board, I sit or I know somebody who's on a regional solutions committee, and all of this change going on in my community, who's coordinating all that? And what happens when there's a conflict between those policy realms? So it's an emerging challenge for us that we're going to have to get our heads around as we move forward. The fourth initiative was about accountability, transparency, innovation, and incentives. And I want to just mention a couple of things. I'll go back to the IT world. One of the fundamental things when you run technology systems is that you must have a common active directory. In other words, a common platform upon which applications can be housed so that you can share those applications across different user groups. We just now, this year, implemented the first common active directory for the state of Oregon on our systems. So up until now, it was extremely difficult technically for us to share applications across our enterprise. So that's been done in the last year. We have what I will call experimental, but we've proved the concept, software platform called Agora that we've been testing in the Mid-Columbia region, which is really a almost like a social networking spot, if I can make an analogy, where people who are trying to produce projects in communities on the ground can be coupled with funders of all different kinds, public and private, and we're trying to build this social space, if you will, for those connections to happen in a much more fluid way. It has proven concept, at least in the Mid-Columbia area, and so we're working with the economic development districts across the entire state to put a federal, state, and philanthropic, I'll say, foundation effort effort together to put that across the entire state and have it be the platform for us to be able to connect funders with projects. And you can imagine the kind of behavioral change we can implement on all party sides if, in fact, we can get folks to really be active in that space. Lastly, the fifth initiative was about a number of pilot projects, case studies, if you will. And the one I wanted to mention was one that was mentioned was a more streamlined and more effective way of getting industrial lands to be in a ready-to-go state of affairs, so ready to be developed. And I just wanted to mention that in the last year, in the metropolitan area in Portland, we were able to get five industrial sites ready to go. The expectation was that we would get three, but I think Greg can attest that through the regional solutions staffing issues and being able to bring our federal partners to the table, we were able to get over a lot of permitting hurdles to make those sites ready, and we hope to be able to do that across the entire state. I've sucked all the oxygen out of the room, and so I'd like to stop there, and I'll pass it to Greg.
Thank you, Director Jordan, and I appreciate that. On your number two point around information technology, I'm actually working on a bill with some others around major IT projects, not what you discussed. I'd love to get together offline and talk a little bit how we sort of give some confidence to some of those things that have gone on historically, and not in an effort to be punitive, but to really set an expectation and provide a pathway we can all agree on. So,
Mr. Chairman,
that,
welcome the engagement. That would be great.
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. And with that, I'd like to hand off the gavel to my co-chair, Representative Barker.
Careful, co-chair Freeman. That could start a bar fight in another time and place. Just wanted to apologize for being late. Representative Gomberg and I had a bill signing, which is a good thing. That means we got it passed.
But the governor was there too.
Yeah, that's right.
Barker's in Hawaii.
Thank you for that. Please go ahead.
Representative Barton, members of the committee, I'm Greg Wolf, Governor Kitz Hubbard's Intergovernmental and Regional Solutions Director. Last session, the legislature approved three positions to add to the regional solutions effort in order to give us the capacity to provide an ombudsman function that was outlined in the report that Scott mentioned, created by the AG and the governor. Since last session, we've begun using our regional coordinators in this role of ombudsman for permits. Specifically, that means that they convene federal, state, and local permitting agencies when significant permits are proposed and ensure that they are moving them through the system as efficiently and as rapidly as possible. One of the things this means is that we need to figure out how we can deal better with the problem that comes from sequential permitting. A lot of times you will have permitting agencies sort of line up. One will go through the permitting process and all the others will wait till that process is done before they begin their process. And if you stretch this out, it can sometimes end up being years before you get through the permitting process. So to the extent we can, we want to get people to do concurrent permitting. And that's one of our objectives. Another is to figure out how we can determine what kind of information is required in a permit from various permitters and have the applicants provide it once rather than repetitively to several different agencies. So that's another way that we think we can speed the process up. And in other cases, we actually need to do, in effect, what is pre-permitting. In other words, get out on the sites, get some sites permitted in a way so that when an industrial user shows up, the permitting work, or at least a large amount of it, is already done. And we find this to be particularly helpful in wetlands permitting, particularly in the Willamette Valley. And there's been one we just worked on in the Port of the Dalles, where there was a site there that had a lot of limitations, and the users there just were confused about where they could actually site. And so we've gone through a pre-permitting process on that that has been very productive. We also have been working with OMB and the Department of Interior sent out a person last year that really functioned as a federal permit ombudsman. Now, the funding for this position ran out, so we're all depressed about that. But while that person was here, we were able to actually get better cooperation from the federal agencies with that person filling this ombudsman role with our regional coordinators at the local level. So we hope to continue to advocate that the federal government will continue that. But even without that, our coordinators can convene these agencies. The governor's a convening authority does extend to some degree to the federal agencies. When we call a meeting, they at least acknowledge they need to respond. Just a couple of examples that we've been working on just this last 6 months. One is there's a problem in eastern Oregon where a lot of communities have had some difficulties managing water and wastewater compliance requirements. And to do that, to address that, the Eastern Oregon Regional Solutions team has got all of these parties together to actually develop some agreements that will hold themselves accountable both to the other agencies as well as the local government. And we hope that we're going to be able to develop those, deliver those projects more quickly at a reduced cost in a way that are supported by local governments. And we're going to roll that out in 2014. Another example is on the coast. There's 9 coastal ports that have a massive kind of permitting challenge in front of them in the boat basins and in the harbors. The Corps of Engineers, as you may know, has started to pull out of the coastal dredging business. And so we've worked on that on the channels. But in these boat basins, there's all this permitting work that still needs to be done. So we're working with about 9 local ports to get together and hire a permitting consultant together so that we can find efficiencies in going through the permitting process. And we've got NOAA to agree to work with us on that, which is an important player in those efforts. Mike mentioned the industrial sites. Again, I think having the coordinator there, somebody who is in a place to pull people together at once is really, really a critical factor in making this kind of work happen. And it's interesting how, you just need somebody who doesn't work for a particular agency, somebody who has a broader portfolio to do that kind of work, and that's what the coordinators have been able to provide. Last thing I would mention is the sage grouse problem in eastern Oregon. Again, one of our coordinators, Jamie Damon, has been facilitating a group that includes the cattlemen, DSL, ODF&W, Department of Agriculture, Water Resources, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, BLM, just a lot of players. Their job is to look at how we can actually create a mitigation strategy so that as we're trying to site power lines and trying to site other wind facilities, things like that, there's a way to actually, because you invariably you're going to go through some kind of sage-grouse habitat when you do this, how can we actually find these other sites where we can mitigate for those losses of habitat and in advance identify how that can happen so that we don't have to wait until the permit is actually requested and have to go through all that work at the same time. So that's another example. We've been working with Representative Bentz as well on some industrial land issues over in Ontario and Nissan Vale.
Representative Bentz, do you mind if we interrupt you?
Sure, no, I'm done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In continuing my effort to prompt people to think about Eastern Oregon in a broader way, I just encourage people not to use the term Eastern Oregon and instead say two-thirds of our state. and two-thirds of our state. So that's an aside. That's not my question. I just want to raise that issue. So I've looked at this, and I have an article here from the 2 weeks ago Economist magazine that talks about it's Buttonwood's subpart, which I love to read. And he says there is the general temptation to add to the weight of regulation. Every year, the World Economic Forum publishes a competitive survey based on interviews with executives. And I'll skip down. Excessive regulation in the EU is hardly a surprise, but there has also been a striking deterioration in the perception of America's regulatory burden. The country has slipped from 23rd to 80th in the global rankings over the past 7 years. What troubles business folk and investors most is the random nature of the process. They do not know where the next, let's skip over this, regulatory boot might descend. When rules are proposed, it can take ages for the details to emerge, making it hard for companies to plan ahead. This is the most insidious and most underestimated form of political risk. It's great to see the three of you throwing yourself into this swamp of regulatory, our regulatory creation. It's just amazing. And very happy you're doing it. Having said all this, I looked at the list of five things, but I nowhere in it saw the prioritization exercise of what where we can spend you guys' efforts the most fruitfully. Perhaps it goes without saying that IT is it, maybe not, but I didn't see that prioritization piece in here because I'm reminded of a presentation 2 days ago about the egalitarian nature of transportation funding. That is, and the analogy used was, it's like spreading peanut butter across the entire state, and everybody gets a little bit, but nobody gets enough. In your case, let's hope that you're doing better than that. You're focused. You can tell me here in an instant that whatever you've done here to achieve what Buttonwood's talking about, to get us back up that ladder of competitiveness, tell me that you prioritize. That's what I want to hear.
We're going to start you off with a softball today.
Please tell us.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, we prioritize. I'm not being facetious. You'll recall my quip, if you will, regarding governance of information technology. We literally, under our current or former historic management structure, we had a very difficult time making a bad decision as an enterprise because we didn't make any decisions as an enterprise. It is very difficult under any circumstance to be able to prioritize limited resources if you aren't managing the entire enterprise, and it's just impossible. And then secondly, all of the work we have to do, and technology is a good example of it, all of the work we have to do, if you had the money and you gave it all to us now, we couldn't spend it all. We literally wouldn't know where to spend it first. So we have to go through those kinds of exercises. To your point about transportation funding, we have a fundamental governance problem that we have to figure out how to engage on. In 2620, what I mentioned about recipients and funders talking in a much more intimate relationship about how we do this work, I'm an old city manager, emphasis on the old, and a county commissioner, and I've worked at the regional level, and I always wanted my part of the pie. No matter how small the pie was, I wanted my piece, and I wasn't really fond of giving it up. That is mutually exclusive from the notion of a limited pot of money being prioritized on a statewide basis to things that may have the most impact for the state. It is a fundamental discussion we have to have between the funds that we get either from the feds or the funds we appropriate from the state and how they are applied to communities. It is a difficult, difficult dynamic to get our heads around. But I acknowledge that it's one we have to.
Representative Bentz, do you want to follow up?
Let Mr. Cole first. Yeah.
Chair Barton, Representative Bentz, on this ombudsman side of the equation, the regional coordinators, their work is really focused on those things that are identified by the regional advisory committees as being priority issues. So we really are trying to prioritize our how we invest our energy on those things that in the region that they identify as the highest on their list.
If I may, please. So I guess my point is that there are certain places where we can spend our time and have a great result, hugely beneficial to the entire state, as opposed to a fairly broad approach, which I see here. And I don't know what technique was used in determining where you were going to expend your efforts first. Because what I would hope to see is, gosh, this is the biggest problem we've got, and it's costing us this many jobs, and it's just a horrible problem, and so we're going to spend our limited resources here. And so that's what I'm asking. I haven't heard the answer just yet.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, how to apply the resources that we have and which problems to apply them to is an artful discussion. I could argue to you that IT is one you should spend a lot of time in, because one of my professors once told me that budgets are BS, audits are history, so follow the cash. And that's where the cash is in our internal service world. It's in IT. So we can make a lot of difference if we can get better there. So that's one way to prioritize. The other way is the low-hanging fruit. So when we come to you with recommendations on 2620 and 14, there will be a number of things in there that aren't really big dollar-wise or leverage-wise, but they're like, does. We can do them in a heartbeat and get it done quickly. So there's kind of two sets of criteria to prioritize our efforts around, and that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you.
We're running out of time with this panel. Co-Chair Freeman.
Great. Thank you, Co-Chair Barton. And again, thank you guys for the work you're doing, and please don't take my comments the wrong way. It amazes me that government solution for a complicated government is more government. So your idea of having people to navigate through this very complicated government system is to hire government people. Nobody ever brings up the idea, how do we get rid of some of the government regulation? And I know that's not your really task, but those things that you may run across that seems like it'd be a great idea to eliminate in a regulatory sense, we'd sure love a heads up on that, because I think there's plenty of people in the building that would like to pursue that.
Welcome to the Small Business Task Force.
Chair Barton, Representative Freeman, we really, that is part of the ombudsman function in our mind. You know, when we run into problems at the local level in doing this permit work, there are obvious problems that are systemic and not specific to the permit, but we need a systemic fix. We're going to bring those back to the governor. And so that there's a feedback loop there that we intend to implement.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you guys for your time. You put this together on relatively short notice. We appreciate it. This task force is focused, of course, on small business. It tends to have a rural tilt, just I think largely because of its membership. But it, like much of your work, it kind of exists between what we traditional committees and traditional groups. And as we try to, I guess, develop an agenda for February 14th session and beyond, we'd really like to work more closely with you guys. There's a tremendous amount of information you dropped. To the extent we can work together, you're welcome here. And Mr. Wolf, on a personal note, as you know, I represent Oregon City. We work together on the Willamette Falls redevelopment site, an issue near and dear to me personally as well as my community. Thank you for your work on that.
Thank you.
Thank you guys very much.
Co-Chair Barton,
yes,
may I add also, on following up on your prior comment, Mr. Wolf, that he glossed over the dredging issue that we've been working on the South Coast. And I can tell you, to bring 9 port entities together who don't normally play particularly well in the same sandbox and have them come together and with a common goal and to get a permitting process through the Corps of Engineers in light speed and to be able to move forward with that project has just been a remarkable thing to work with. And I give your shop a lot of credit for how that thing is rolled out. So thank you also for your great work on that project.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
By talking about the coast in eastern Oregon, he was playing to the crowd. Right? Well,
got it.
Thank you, guys.
We got the East Coast and the West Coast here.
Two-thirds of Oregon and
that's right.
I'll take a third.
Well, thank you. Okay, we're going to close the informational meeting on the economic impact of small businesses. On regulatory streamline, we're going to open informational meeting.
Permit number 5, last Friday.
On the economic impact of small businesses in the arts and culture industry. We'd like to, we have 2 people signed up. You're most welcome. Come on up.
Hello.
Again, thank you guys for coming.
Keep your pen out.
It's nice to see you here today.
Thank you.
You're welcome to go in any order you wish. It's, of course, as a formality, you have to identify your name for the record.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting us to provide this information. I'm Shannon Planchon, the Interim Director of the Oregon Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust, and I'm joined by Julie Bigland, who's mostly here for moral support for me because I'm new to this process. So.
Well, this is, with the exception of some tough questions last time, this is a friendly crowd.
Yes.
And we appreciate what you do.
We're very happy you're here.
Okay.
If you need some water, just let us know. But please go ahead. You're most welcome here.
So I was asked to provide information on 4 points, and I'm hopeful I've done that. And I did it in a slightly different order than you asked. It was economic impact of small business and the arts, funding of the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust, the grant programs of the Commission and Trust, and then the history behind housing the Commission and the Cultural Trust within Business Oregon. And I hope that I cover all these points, but I've done it kind of in an order that made sense to me, kind of the funnel process. And, oh, look. So the Arts Commission was established in 1968. We were kind of, Congress initiated, I think, the National Endowment for the Arts in 1965, and they said, if you have a state arts agency, you get to share in part of the money. And so in 4 years, I believe, nearly every state had a state arts agency. We worked to increase public access to the arts. We want to make sure that every person has that wants it enjoys the cultural, civic, economic, and educational benefits of a thriving arts sector. We do that through grants. We do that through technical assistance. We do a lot of different activities with 6 full-time staff. And so that's who we are. We were an independent agency until 1993. There was a very tumultuous year, I believe, here in Oregon. I was not here at the time. The legislature had a $1.2 billion shortfall, and the Arts Commission was facing a bunch of cuts. And so one of the strategies was to move into the then Economic Development Department, which was designed to help shore up our infrastructure and consolidate like services. We have 9 commissioners who are appointed by the governor. They determine art needs and establish policies for public support for the arts. Julie Vigeland's our chair. We only have 1 vacancy at the time for the Portland area. Crystal Williams left to join, take a position at Bates College in Maine. So we've lost a great poet and a commissioner, so we're sorry to lose her. The funding sources for the commission are pretty easy. We get these are based on the biennium, $1.4 million from the National Endowment for the Arts. The general fund generously supports us with about $4.3 million. And then we get other funds from the Cultural Trust. We receive a partner grant. We have a great partnership right now with the Ford Family Foundation. We're receiving $390,000 roughly. We've had other foundations supporting our efforts across the state. And then we receive Percent for Art funds, which is a small portion of the public art budgets that we help administer the programs. So we have a staff person that helps shepherd those programs through to contracting. These are all of our grant programs. We have a lot of them. I think that I was listening with interest to this discussion about kind of joining funding and different programs, so I'd be curious to learn more about that. Some of these are very small, and when we have a constituency that appreciates a small grant, $1,000 will help a very small organization get a seal of approval from the Arts Commission, and they really value that because it tells their community and other funders that the Arts Commission, while we don't give large grants, we evaluate with a peer panel and say that what the work they're doing is valuable. And so that's something we really look at when we think about getting rid of programs. We're like, yeah, we do have a constituency for almost all of, well, we have a constituency for all of them, but that is a question that comes up. The access reimbursement is a new one in the past 2 or 3 years, and that one is, as we look at making sure everyone can participate, we want to help organizations understand that they have to comply with the 504 ADA. And so we offer funds to reimburse them for expenses up to, I believe, $1,000, mostly so they learn, A, it's not that expensive, and B, it's pretty easy to do. So that's been pretty successful. Port Orford did a ramp on one of their buildings, and so we're happy with that. I can answer other questions about grants later. We also offer grants for individuals. This is for artistic excellence. The career opportunity is one that the Ford Family Foundation supports with us. They have we offer grants for artists who have a unique opportunity to advance their career. So this is it can't just be I want to make more work. It has to be I have been invited to participate in a residency at a national like Anderson Ranch, or I can publish my book if I have an editor to finish the final edits. Cheryl Strayed, who wrote Wild, was actually received a career opportunity grant to help edit her book before it went to publish. We're very happy for her. And then the Ford Family Foundation looked at our processes and said, you guys do a good job. You bring together people who are thoughtful, evaluate, talk about the activity they want to do. And so we would like to offer more money to visual artists because that's our focus. And so once we review ours, if they meet the goals of their program, they're up for an additional $6,500 that comes from the other funds. It's a great, great program, and I hope to actually find other foundations to support the other disciplines. It's on the wish list. The Cultural Trust was established by the legislature in 2001, and they have the mission to enhance the lives of Oregonians by implementing a sustainable public-private integrated cultural funding program. This is a national model. It's looked upon, you know, throughout as one of the most creative uses of leveraging private and public funds. It's unique, and we're very proud of it. We have They are funded by the cultural tax credit, the sale of cultural license plates, and then when it was first started, we were going to get the transfer of state surplus property assets. So if something was sold, we would get that revenue to help build up what was then set out to be a $200 million fund. That hasn't come to play yet, but in 2002, the framework actually became active. So then it was like people were looking at how things were actually going to work. You know, you create a big plan, a big bold idea, and then you kind of start working through and getting things in play. So then in 2003, of course, there's another budget downturn. And the trust was moved to the Oregon Arts Commission from the Secretary of State's office because we had expertise in grant making, arts and cultural information, and then cultural community development. So once again, trying to leverage the staff. So we have two boards in our small division. We have the Cultural Trust, which is governed by a 13-member board. These members are appointed by the governor and then approved by the Senate. And then the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate each appoint a member. So right now we have Representative Doherty, and then we just got news that Senator Steiner Hayward will be on our board. So we're looking forward to welcoming her. So the funding sources for the Cultural Trust, the administration, there's a small, very small percentage that comes from contributions each year that we're allowed to use for the administration. Again, these are biennium numbers, so that's $260,000. The Arts Commission has a grant that we make to the trust, so there's a little bit of transfer. And then the revenue from the sale of cultural license plates, we're allowed to use that strictly for administration, marketing, and outreach so that we can help develop the fund to a more robust place where we can spin off more money. In the 10 years, we've had over 21,000 Oregonians donate more than $32 million to the trust. And during that time, we've made over $14 million in grant awards throughout the state. So we're very proud of that. We have three grant categories. These are very clearly articulated in statute, so this is how we do it. There's cultural development grants, cultural participation grants, which is the grant that goes to every single county in the state. There's a county coalition, which we're proud of because it's created a network. And then cultural partners are the Arts Commission, the Historical Society, SHPO, organizations that have a statewide presence and support arts, heritage, and humanities. And then, we said, the economic impact of small businesses in the arts and culture industry. And we, of course, this generated a lot of discussion in our office because we're like, okay, how do we do this? And so we talked about how we could present it, and we thought we could give you a big, long list of all the different businesses and organizations that are creative and based in culture, or we could give you a picture of three different areas. And we went for the picture. So then we said, how do we define small business? And we've actually talked about this quite a bit over time because we work with so many different organizations. So we look at this as organizations that employ 100 or fewer. That's most all of the organizations we work with, except perhaps the Shakespeare Festival. That's in the nonprofit specific arts industry. But then we also had the advantage of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition commissioned this study last year, so December 2012, and had a lot of interesting information. I believe I gave you the executive summary of this. But it said in 2011,
We have 1,300 cultural eligible nonprofits. That means they're nonprofit organizations in the state of Oregon that provide cultural programming. And you, if you go to our website, you can see a list of who they are in your community. $580 million in sales, and they employed over 8,000 people.
Wow.
That's cool. You know, people don't realize that we're just small organizations, yeah. And a lot of them are nonprofit, but they're working and they're paying their taxes.
That's fabulous.
So
yeah.
It's a great number. So our primary relationship with organizations and businesses is nonprofits, but we do maintain an interest and relationship in the creative sector. And we've chosen these few areas, and we're starting with Astoria, because this is actually kind of a typical small town in many ways. I mean, they've done a lot of work, and you can see I've got 15 businesses. Mm-hmm. These, some are nonprofit, some are for-profit, some are state agencies, but they all have a creative and cultural impact in their town. They contribute to the vitality of Astoria and bring people in. Mm. Lightbox Gallery, mm-hmm. We've worked with Mike Granger for quite a while. This is a nice storefront in Astoria. He's a local gallery. He's got a very strong online presence. He's the owner, and he's like, there weren't enough opportunities for photographers in town, in the state of Oregon. So he has an additional venue over and above the Portland-based places.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to seem rude.
Yes.
I apologize. As it turns out, even though there are so many committee hearings, committee rooms are empty right now. There's another committee coming in.
Oh, no.
I didn't know that either. Otherwise,
okay. That's okay for me.
And yes, indeed. So to the extent either you have like a final slide or want to wrap
up. Okay, let me do that. That's great.
No. There really is.
We're all on the side of the table.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this does happen in this building.
Okay.
There is an awesome story to be told.
Yep.
About the economic impacts that arts, culture, and heritage play in the state around.
Good.
And you really are doing a great job of it. It affects all of our districts, and it's a wonderful thing. And
so,
to the extent this committee can help you,
okay.
Don't hesitate to call upon us.
You'll do this? You have this thing, and I'm happy to show it to anybody who wants it, but I appreciate your time. And you want me to just go to the end?
As you wish, yeah. We need to wrap up.
Okay, I was just going to say, is this up on Olis so we can take a look at the rest of her slides also, which we would be delighted to do.
Okay. Then I don't think I can say anything other than we have lots of jobs being created through the cultural sector, and we hope that you continue to support us as we go into the next session. But go to Artula in Bandon.
Yay for Bandon.
Yeah. So you've got some great, great strength here. Clackamas County, and I think that's it.
Well, you know, the Arts Commission as it's kind of bounced around, is now kind of awkwardly housed in Business Oregon. Which, similarly, in the legislature, your issues have bounced around from committee to committee, which is one of the reasons why you came here. We work kind of between traditional groups. You're always welcome here, and thank you for coming in.
Okay, thank you.
We are going to close that informational hearing, and unless there's any further business,
we are going to close
today's meeting. Thank you much.
So we all
Thank you much.
So we all
close today's meeting.